Yeah, and we are go. All right, hey, it's Saturday, so this is Different Order of Magnitude. Glad to have you with us. Politics and pop culture, and yeah, so things. how so? Witten Watson, joined as always by my good friend Kevin Willis. Politics this week. A couple of housekeeping things. I'm going to set up a bunch of other social media type things this week. I know it's been promised often, but yeah, this week I can totally get to it. Yeah, so that's coming, so look out for that. Also, just a heads up, look out for setting up our Defenders, our podcast about the upcoming show on Netflix. Defenders, Best Defense, discussion of Defenders, our Defenders podcast. I'll be kind of hitting the airwaves with all that this week, as it were. All right, so in terms of politics this week, though, we're going to talk about, I guess, the foreign trip. I guess that's been big in the news. Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, the president's trip to Saudi Arabia, now to Brussels, this kind of various international tour, and well, the Vatican as well. I can't remember exactly all the stops. Perhaps touch briefly, well, not briefly, we could discuss the Manchester bombing somewhat, and then for big kind of philosophical consideration, something universal employment and also universal employment versus or with a guaranteed minimum income. Those are two kind of big philosophical, I guess philosophical, very, very large kind of policy issues that I've been interested in. I'll just start out by asking Kevin, have you seen much of the foreign trip? Or I mean, there hasn't been, in some ways there hasn't been that much to see. But I mean, it's been kind of an uneventful trip that to Saudi Arabia, to the Vatican.
Yeah, mostly, I've just seen the observation that Saudi is the first time a president has made Saudi Arabia their first stop on a given trip. And in terms of their further, a president making the first country he goes to, Saudi Arabia, and trying to make hay out of that, I'm not sure that that's a big deal. He goes to the place where the money is. That's the first big money source. And there seems to be a certain questionable hypocrisy in it, going to a very wealthy state that obviously is not as part of the Muslim travel ban that he attempted to institute initially, though obviously a tremendous source of terrorism in the past. So it seems to be, for all his pretend to populism and promise of it not being politics as usual, a lot of it is still politics as usual. The 3 a.m. tweeting may be different, but I don't see anything particularly significant in his making Saudi Arabia the first stop versus previous presidents. It's still, it's posturing and then going where the money is.
Why is it? I'm curious. Why is it going where the money is? I'm not sure I'm following that.
Saudi Arabia
I know it
purchases
has money.
huge amounts of and another way to put it might be doing what the military industrial complex wants them to do, which is frequently what the president does, no matter what they promise. The actual behavior of any given administration seems to be generally consistent with what the Department of Defense, what the military contractor, what the big money in the government actually wants the president to ultimately do. There's not a huge difference from administration to administration in terms of, what countries they're friendly with, what kind of policies they take in terms of selling of arms. What sort of money is ultimately spent on quote unquote defense? What kind of budget the Defense Department gets? It always tends to be the same, administration in, administration out. And I think again, keeping things friendly and kind of putting signing the final, because there was a huge arms deal that was part of this particular trip, and that's one of the things that Trump did to do while I was there. So it's about the money.
Really, there was the arms deal. That was interesting. I guess I mean, if it's I mean, I see your point about the money, or I see your point about, I mean, American foreign policy, American defense policy. I mean, there's often there's a lot of consistency to American policy. So I guess yeah, I'm
Which could be
not.
good. I mean, it
Yeah,
could also
no,
be
that's no.
too expensive. It
No, I.
means we don't go crazy every time we elect a new president.
No, I no. That's a very good point. Yeah, I mean that kind of disrupt. There's all kind of downsides to that kind of disruption. There's a lot to be gained for that kind of consistency. I guess I'm struck. I mean, I am struck by what a lot of people have said about the true how he acts on foreign affairs, which is that he's friendly to enemies and hostile to friends. And yeah, I think it is kind of bizarre, right? You see him. He's very. Right, he has all this praise for Duterte. Duterte, who's president of the Philippines, engaged in all these extra legal killings. Saudi Arabia, he seems delighted to be there doing the sword dancing and all this. And then you get him to, then, but Angela Merkel, Macron, right, the body language, everything is really different. And yeah, I want, I mean, I can think of many different explanations for that. He had just a liking strong man, just a fondness for these authoritarian leaders, which is rather.
He has an affinity for male dictators. That's
Yeah, and I wondered. I mean, a lot of people pointed out. I think it was with the International Olympics Committee back when they had Juan Antonio Samaranch, who you were supposed to refer. He was the president of the International Olympic Committee, and you were to refer to him as Your Excellency, just so you know. If that ever comes up, but a lot of people pointed out that the Olympics really liked these harsh authoritarian totalitarian regimes because they could just grab all this money and spend all these funds on this Olympic nightmare and not have to be hassled by and not have to be hassled by a
That
democratic.
is how to describe most Olympics,
Yeah,
is what
and
they go
not
to, Olympic nightmares.
and you're not and you're not being hassled by a democratic populace. I mean, I had tremendous. I don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole. I had a lot of admiration for Atlanta that actually went to the trouble of making money on its Olympics. And earned right some snooty some I guess well I guess it was some criticism by the IOC about that or some mild criticism, but whatever. Good for Atlanta. Yeah, so I kind of wonder. I mean, if it's is it just that Saudi Arabia will do this incredible pageantry for you? Is that what attracts the president? Right, you do this sword dance thing. France and Germany are not going to give you sword dances, right? France, they're not going to present you with a gold collar. So I wonder if that's part of it. Also, I just wonder if it's you do what Obama didn't do, right? Whatever Obama did, right? Be on good terms with our allies. You do the opposite of that. Maybe that's it. I guess the but and I think to pick up on something you kind of hinted at, or this is bluster. I mean, this kind of stuff doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, all this. I mean, he'll say these bad things. He'll say Germany's bad. We're going to stop them selling all these cars. But this is all bluster. I mean, this is not Germany's not really your problem. The United States is a problem. Greece, right? Germany is a problem for Greece. It's not really a problem for us. I guess it was one last. I was trying to think. It was one last thing I wanted to add about the international aspect. And it's escaping me now. Okay. I would say the one significant. I'll stop after this. But I guess the one substantive, or I guess the one really worrying thing, is Iran recently. Iran recently had an election, and moderates did pretty well. The moderates beat out the extremists in Iran, and it's a hopeful sign. Cozying up Saudi Arabia, or all this friendliness to Saudi Arabia right after those elections with no kind of olive branch or any kind of thing to Iran seems to me not the greatest idea. I mean, I think it might be, it may, I think you could offer some kind of support or some kind of encouragement to the moderates in Iran for very little cost, if anything, right? Just a few kind words or something like that, or even something less significant than that. And it seems to me that's possibly a real missed opportunity. So.
Yeah, but that doesn't surprise me.
Really?
Trump tends to take a hard line as for what he asks for what he wants in terms of he's subtle diplomacy is beyond him. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, I guess I also had the spectacle of Trump not really affirming Article 5, which is the commitment of NATO nations to come to the support of one another, and all the aides and other people running around saying no, we're still really into that. I mean, it's kind of a constant spectacle with this administration of people running around saying, no, whatever signal you were getting from the president, that's totally not right. It's totally the opposite of what seemed very obvious. So that was curious.
I think in the Trump administration, probably more so than other administrations, but in all administrations, there's a certain kind of disagreement on what the message should be, what the priority should be. And I think you're seeing some of that. Although, in Trump ultimately does spend time playing to the base, and most of his base doesn't particularly think that we need to be financing European defense or the military adventurism of Europe in a post-Soviet Union era. Whether that's true or not is another question, but I think a lot of that is just why are we paying for France and Germany to defend themselves, and I think that plays well with a certain segment of America that
seems totally
doesn't agree we need to be spending all this money in foreign defense support.
That seems wholly out of line with reality. I mean, that seems wholly divorced from the reality of the situation.
Well, the one thing I would say, and I think it's true, because a lot of the criticism is kind of, you shouldn't even ask, why are we spending this money? And I think part of the division there is a sense that it's, self-evident and there should be no need to explain, why we're spending the money, what the money's going to, what the goals it's trying to accomplish. You hear the metrics as to what it is, accomplished in the post-Soviet era. Are we just doing this because we've always done it? And, I think that could be fairly addressed. But Trump kind of plays into that with his whole, we're going to pull out NATO approach. Tends to avoid that conversation as well. There's a way to encourage that conversation, which is not what the Trump administration is doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to scrap aspects of NATO, I suppose I'm certainly willing to talk about that. But I've seen no alternative on the table so far. And the argument for NATO, I think, is you haven't had a major European war, Serbia, Bosnia, those kind of situations aside. I mean, you haven't had a major European conflict since World War II. I think it's definitely one of the most successful military alliances in history. I mean,
Gotta keep in mind while we're in NATO. We're in NATO not to prevent European wars per se so much as stop the advance of the Soviet Union and keep the entire European continent from becoming part of the USSR. And that goal seems to have passed by, so it's a matter of saying, do we still have an interest in NATO, and or do we care if Europe goes to war with itself?
I think you actually do care. I mean, you have major.
You do. But I mean, it's an argument to discuss. It was an easier argument to make for most of the American people when it was about preventing the encroachment of the USSR on all of Europe. Now that it's more of a different discussion, I understand why certain people would want to, consider lessening support for NATO, requiring that Europe pay for more of its own defense, that sort of thing. Why does all it have to fall on America? I think that's a reasonable point to make. But Trump's approach is, it's useless. We don't need it anymore.
Which
I don't think is true.
Honestly, even if you dropped out of NATO, would you still maintain the most powerful army in the world? You almost certainly would. It seems to me NATO is relatively, it's relatively low cost relative to the benefits. I mean, I just don't see. I mean, all right, fine. You drop out of NATO, and I guess you there's some modest short-term financial gain. I mean, what are your fantastic plans for this money? I mean, I'm just not clear on that.
Yeah, well, I think dropping out, the whole dropping out of NATO thing is campaigning. It's not about something structural that we would act, the government would actually do with the money in terms of it's about campaigning. It's about appealing to the base.
Well, when do you stop campaigning and start governing? I mean, I think that's probably like what a lot of, I mean, a lot of
With
people.
with Trump, I'm not sure that you ever
Yeah,
stop
you're never. Yeah, it's
campaigning.
yeah. You're never. It's never going to stop. All right. Perhaps we should move on to Manchester. Do you want to touch on that briefly, or do you have anything
Yeah,
to add
sure.
on international? Okay, so there was the horrific Manchester bombing of this Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England. Of course, suicide bombing and unspeakably horrific. I'll leave all the true crime elements out of this. Those have been publicized elsewhere. But I guess the question is, so what sort of lessons do we take from this? What sort of implications do we think this have, if any? Is this just another is this just another situation that we're going to be seeing more of? I mean, I suspect that's true, but is there something we can learn from this? Is there some positive takeaway? Is there something good we can get out of this? And I guess I'll throw it to you.
It feels to me like the goals of these individual terrorists, at least, is just to make, modern life in the Western world increasingly more inconvenient. I mean, that ultimately is the outcome of things like this. Some people die. It's very tragic for the families and the people who know them. But the general societal shift is always, a broader perimeter, more security checkpoints, newer, more sophisticated metal or other types of bomb detectors, that sort of thing. More inconvenience and delay and expense for maintaining the same general structure to life. And I mean, that's ultimately all that ever seems to happen. The goal is to produce an Islamic caliphate. This isn't doing it. If the goal is to, end or enhance conflicts between the West and elements of radical Islam, this also isn't doing it. They're beyond the point. If the goal is to foster more resentment to Islam and the infidels, I don't think they can at this point. So, I mean, it seems like it's just a pointless exercise in religious fanaticism. It's just it, these are just individuals that are unfortunately given support by, I suppose, ideologues who themselves tend to be. So a lot of people involved just have to be nuts. They just have to want to do this for whatever reason and rationalizing it by whatever basis they can. But in terms of overall societal shift, I think some of it's just kind of going to be the new normal. It's just how things are going to be. These things will occasionally happen, and security will be beefed up. But Ariana Grande is not going to be stopping music. They're not going to stop pop music. They're not going to stop sexually liberated, quote unquote, females from dancing and singing songs about love and sex and everything else. It's just not going to happen. So they're still going to be concert. Little teen girls are still going to go to them. There's not going to be a radical transformation of Western culture based on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, let me on the one hand, I definitely agree that I mean, terrorism has become rather perplexing in that there does seem to be a total disconnect between your efforts and any hope or chance of success. I mean, an incredibly successful attack like 9/11, the markets are back in almost no time. I mean, the recovery
But
time.
also, at least with 9/11, that was the heart of the financial center. In many ways, that was a strike at the heart of the beast. I understand, the goal there, and it was super destructive. If I were a terrorist and wanted this kind of destruction of Western society, I'd say, okay, well, we struck a really good blow. It's not a killing blow, but it's really good. Ariana Grande concert, clubs in Florida, what they're doing now is just, it's like, remember us? You hate us, right? You remember us? We're still, nothing at this point that they're doing is successfully advancing. I can't imagine anything that they actually want to accomplish in terms of some kind of overarching war against the West or, supremacy of Islam, or radical Islam, their particular flavor of it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we agree that there seems to be a real disconnect between the actions and any kind of expectation of success. I think my point with 9/11 is just that that's an incredibly successful attack, and the West, America recovers pretty fast. America bounces back in a pretty amazing way, and it's an incredibly successful attack, but it's really not that big an impact in the grand scheme of things. I guess where I possibly see some kind of success, and it would be a rather twisted argument, is that if you can carry out these attacks and turn European countries, France, Britain, Germany, if you can really turn them against large-scale immigration, and I think there's a lot of, and I think there's a lot of understandable opposition in those countries to large-scale immigration, then I think in other countries, Northern Africa, the Middle East, maybe people are stuck with no alternative, and maybe people are just stuck there, and ISIS maybe doesn't look that bad if there's nowhere else to go. I mean, I think that's important. I think that's a pretty tortured case, and I'm not really sure. I certainly don't think it's a very strong argument, but it's kind of the best I can imagine right at the moment. All right, well, do you have anything to add to that, or do you want to move on to universal employment, guaranteed basic income?
Just that from the overall response, we're going to have the same kind of problem. I know there's been some follow-up stories after the Manchester bombing that the suspect has been flagged as a potential terrorist risk. I think British security services were warned like 5 times about him taking up suicide bombing. So there's a question, too, as to, under the surveillance state, what good does that do you in terms of terrorism if there seems to be, by its very nature, it's always going to seem like you need to take action because every successful terrorist attack is going to be one where the person was surveilled and probably flagged as a risk, and yet nothing happened. If those you prevent, you don't know because you can't prove a negative. But in all these cases, you're going to see, he was warned about it. Someone said, the father came out and said, he's going to bomb somebody. Without getting too specific, there's a lot of indication of risk for these people. But then if you go start rounding them up before they've done anything, you're also going to be accused of trampling on civil rights. It's kind of like there's a no-win for the surveillance state. The surveillance state seems mainly to be a product to tell us why whatever happened, rather than actually do a lot to prevent the kind of things that still are happening. An observation.
Yeah, I guess there I would be concerned about. I guess there I'd be worried about visibility or success bias. Success bias is that you think something is succeeding because you see the successes, right? If you walk around America, you think anyone can open a pizza joint and make a go of it. And that's because you see the successes, right? You don't see all the failures, right? So there's a bias to think that success is possible. There's also visibility, right? If something is visible, you tend to, like a very visible terrorist attack, you tend to think those are really... Yeah, I mean, there can be a bias toward thinking that these things are really prevalent, and it is. You make a good point, right? You don't see, if there are large numbers of attacks that are stopped and you're just not seeing them, your data set is definitely incomplete. It's an interesting problem. All right, good. Okay, well then let's move to. Big mouthful words there, but universal employment versus a minimum income or a minimum basic income, minimum basic amount of wealth. So I'll just lay these out briefly, and probably And I think right now, guaranteed minimum income is getting more attention. And rather obviously, it's like it sounds. Everyone would be guaranteed a certain amount of monies, no matter what, right? Whether you're working or not. So I don't know. The numbers, you can put the numbers anywhere you want. You might imagine something like you're a family of four. You would receive $50,000 a year, no questions asked. You're an individual, a bachelor, a bachelorette. Single, I suppose maybe you would receive $10,000, $15,000 a year, no questions asked, right? No strings attached. Everyone simply receives annually, or however you want to do this, a certain amount of monies or a certain amount of income, guaranteed basic income. So that's pretty straightforward. And this might be too much to take on, but there's also guaranteed universal employment, right? So you come up with ways, various ways of making sure that everyone has a job, everyone has access to a job. So I guess we could do guaranteed basic income first. What do you think?
The biggest problem, of course, is just going to be the expense. It becomes a question of it's not a bad idea in theory, except, where's the money going to come from ultimately? And, are those people going to want to agreeably part with their wealth or just a bit of their income that they get from working to people who, by definition, don't work or don't work in that or don't have to work. I think that becomes a problem. It is, it's glossed over or is ameliorated by the fact that everybody gets the same income. So you go, well, I'm getting that money back. But at some point, there's got to be a point where you're taking more from some to give to be able to provide a universal basic income for everybody. I think it would the general idea of it that it would ease economic downturns. It would help even out the peaks and valleys, the roller coaster of our economy. I think is true. It's just a matter of where's that money going to come from.
Well, suppose I make the argument that, look, you're a wealthy doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, or whatever, right? I mean, is it in effect in your interest to take some people out of the job market, right? Is it in effect, I mean, if there are fewer of you, your skills, your talents are more desirable. That might be one way of making the case. Another way of making the case, and I think this is a pretty strong one, is if you're just giving people money, right, then you cut out a lot of these other social programs. Like you just get rid of food stamps, you just get rid of these various other programs that require administration, that require bureaucracies, that require these ongoing entitlements. Now you're replacing it kind of with the ultimate entitlement, I admit, of guaranteed basic income. But I can see that being one way of making, I mean, I do see that as being one way of making the case for it. I don't know, I'm interested in universal basic income. I know. Do you think? Let me ask. And this is something I haven't really thought about enough, and perhaps it's not really fair to ask you. But is there something? I guess one question would be: are there measures short of that that would address the problems you're trying to address with guaranteed basic income?
I can't really think of any because ultimately it comes down to the same thing, trying to get money to people who need it and who cannot access it any other way. If there were ways to improve the performance of welfare, if there's a way to improve the performance of your other assistance programs, to focus them on people who cannot get the money any other way, then that might be beneficial because more money could be focused on more needy people. There's a certain amount of able-bodied people who receive assistance, people who could find employment or work, who simply either do not want to or do not want to go through the effort of negotiating a labyrinth of determining, you know, what they need to do to actually earn a regular income. Because, you know, if you're making a survivable living off of assistance, even if it's barely survivable, why bother actually working for it if it's hard to see a point where you would ever make any more than what you're able to get off assistance? If that could be improved, I think that might be better overall in terms of just general, you know, improvement of the economy, those kind of economic goals. But in terms of the overall, the simplicity of universal income, I don't think anything is going to compare to that. It has one complicating factor, which is paying for it. And also the adjustment period, because particularly in a country as large as ours, if you go through the adjustment period of moving to a universal basic income, the deficits will go up tremendously. But, you know, will they go up more than during the stimulus at the end of the Bush administration and at the beginning of the Obama administration? Probably not. I mean, ultimately, we gave enough money to the banks that I think if that were a regular thing, that it would probably cover the universal basic income. It's just particularly in a country of our size, I think it would be, the outset would probably be economically devastating.
Huh. The simplicity argument is interesting. I had not emphasized that as much as you did. I think that's a good point. The simplicity argument has a lot of appeal to it. I do wonder, especially with a lot of these rural areas, and I hate the way that makes me sound, but I do kind of wonder if you're going to end up subsidizing them one way or the other. I mean, there's often this argument that housing, welfare, Medicaid, you're basically subsidizing McDonald's, right? You're basically making, McDonald's isn't paying a living wage, so you're making up for that, making it possible for people to actually live and get by and work at McDonald's. That, however, I would have to say is kind of a concern I would have about universal basic income. I guess there is the question of why is this not just a way of subsidizing existing companies? Why is this not just like, if you're giving people, if there's this guaranteed amount of money, I mean, then why do, it seems like possibly you're just subsidizing companies because then they just lower their wages until they get to that point. I don't know. It's interesting. I do see a lot of difficulties with it.
But also, it may make it easier for certain companies to make a broader segment of their workforce part time and thus deny them benefits. But you can afford to be part time because you get your universal basic income.
So if I'm paying you $5,000 and the government is giving you $5,000 to make up for the $5,000 I'm not giving you, then, yeah, you wonder if that does become kind of government subsidizing certain industries that would be able to take advantage of this. We should probably. I am interested in the audacity of the idea. I have to admit, one thing that's really given me pause is the opioid crisis. That has really changed my views about a lot of things. I used to be much more libertarian about drugs. Mainly because for me, drug use means something is innocent and relatively harmless as marijuana, right? I personally have trouble imagining any interest in something more serious than that, but a lot of people are apparently interested in drugs that are much, much more serious than marijuana. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm terrified that kind of a universal basic income would be a, you know, idle hands or the devil works, or idle hands or the devil's workshop situation, you would have, well, you would explode the opioid crisis or something akin to that more than you already have. That is pretty terrifying. So, sadly, the opioid crisis, it's been a real blow to my libertarian views. So,
the opioid crisis is got a lot of elements in it, which you've got the pharmaceutical companies. Most of the opioid crisis is a product of, you know, a professionally manufactured product, and there, it often starts as a actual prescription.
Let me just let me let me
I think there's a sense of the people that, well, you know, this is a legitimate thing, so this is safe. You know, I don't want to shoot heroin into my veins, but just taking this pill is fine. And then that goes to, ooh, well, you know, why not break the pill apart and snort it? That goes faster. Everyone tells me it does.
Yeah, so
it gets worse and worse.
Let me interject. I mean, one of the really sad things about the opioid crisis, I mean, chronic pain, I mean, chronic suffering is a real problem. And a lot of these drugs are miracle drugs. I mean, they can really serve a really good purpose.
A real miracle drug, if they ever come up with one that can blot pain without getting you high. Tickling that dopamine addiction.
Yeah, blessing. Yeah, mixed blessings, right? That is the nature of humanity. Sure. What about universal employment, right? This is simply the notion, right? You would have a guaranteed. There would be a guaranteed job by various means. Do we have any interest in that? I mean, I'm very interested in this.
You're going to have to make being able to. Ejaculate your opinions onto the internet a really viable economic form to get universal employment. Otherwise, to get universal employment, it's going to be very difficult because you have to have jobs to feed that. Unless you know we're going to characterize getting a whole raft of training, education, and job aptitude tests. That's really as part of the universal employment package. Because in terms of, we're just seeing a fall off for decades now of manual labor jobs or, low-skill labor. So you're going to have to find a way to employ these people in some productive capacity.
I don't
think ultimately just busy work is going to do it.
That
is useful. But there are certain things that can be done that have to be done by a person. So there's a lot that can be done. In general, in maintenance, a lot like the Army, where you paint the barracks every 6 weeks, whether they need it or not. I mean, some of that is just a matter of making things a lot nicer and cleaner and better than they normally are, because that requires human labor. There's a reason why there's trash and weeds by the side of the road, why there's grass that needs to be cut for months before it finally is. Because of the expense of that. And if you're going to direct money towards manual labor jobs, you could do it there. I mean, there's a lot of potential employment there. And there's for the rest of it, I don't know where it's going to come from, but I think it's ultimately better for everybody because we're wired where it's just better for us as human beings to do something for our compensation, even if anything amazing, just to do something.
I think that's especially your last point. I think that's kind of, in a lot of ways, that's a very powerful and fundamental argument. Like your right, why do you really want this kind of, why do you really want generally universal unemployment? And one of the answers is because you don't know what the hell it's, you don't, no one knows what the hell else you would do if males 18. No one knows what the hell else you would do if males 18 to 25, right? They're a nightmare. Mm-hmm. You got to figure out something to do with them. I think it's an excellent point about gainful employment being something very beneficial to human beings. And yeah, you could make this case. I mean, this is what you're getting for this. I think another way I would make the case for universal employment is I think I would say, look, I have friends who live in these very nice, very large houses, and that's fantastic, right? And those are great houses and great properties, and that's wonderful. But you live amongst public squalor, right? You live amongst deteriorating pipes, right? You live amongst deteriorating roads. You live amongst public parks that are not being kept up. I mean, I think one way perhaps of making the case would be, there's this public squalor aspect that needs to be addressed. I mean, your houses have gotten larger and much nicer in some ways. That is a wonderful thing, right? That's to be celebrated. That's a good thing. I guess I worry that's been matched by public squalor, that's been matched by a real deterioration of the public areas. I guess another area where I would think that there's been a market failure or failure to address an evident need would be healthcare and care for the elderly. Now, I am a little curious as to what happens when the baby boomers all finally die off, and there are far fewer older people to take care of. I am also kind of fascinated to know what how this would play out in terms of immigration. I mean, if I were someone who were really interested in halting illegal or even legal immigration, universal employment would be an interesting way of doing that. I mean, that you would have to, you would, I think, have to have some controls just on the number of people you're dealing with. So.
No, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fascinating. Okay. Well, anything you want to add about those or?
No, probably time to move on for the day, as I do have a hard stop probably in about 20 minutes. So if we're
okay.
Going to do the other one, we got to get going.
That's fine. All right, give me 2 seconds and I will. All right, so peace out. Different Order of Magnitude. Thanks for checking us out. Lots of stuff in your notes this week. All right, have a great week. Thanks for being here. See you later. Bye.